Hello, welcome and thank you for joining us and listening to our podcast, The God Beyond the Bible. Our podcast is released weekly each Friday. The content of each episode is based on the questions and curiosities we all have about God and the Bible. Many of our topics are considered taboo in the minds of the mainstream church. You will find our discussions to be, I think, refreshing and often far from traditional. But we don't just skirt around these complex issues, but confront them head on, and not in the way you're used to hearing them discussed on typical Christian talk shows. I'm Alan Rowland, creator and host of The God Beyond the Bible. As of the launch of this podcast, I've been a pastor for more than 35 years. My co-host is my daughter, Trayson, and our engineer co-producer is my daughter, Tabitha. Our mission is to encourage our audience, along with us, to open our minds to the reality that God is simply too big to be fully explored or experienced by the reading and studying of a single ancient work. In short, the Bible's not the sum of God, and to think this is to limit what He has done, is doing, and what He will do in our future. So with introductions made, thank you for listening, and let's dive into the topic of the day. And welcome, listeners, to episode 74 of God Beyond the Bible. Just in case you haven't heard, this is the podcast inspired, created, and hosted by seekers and for seekers. We think our mission is all in our name, you know, God Beyond the Bible. And that is that there's so much more to the Almighty than the small glimpse that ancient seekers were inspired to record of their personal experience with Him. As our intro states, in short, the Bible's not the sum of all that God has done, is doing, or ever will do. How about shout-outs?
All right. We want to give a shout-out this week to all of our listeners in Winston-Salem.
There we go.
Goodness gracious. I'm going good already. Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Thanks for listening, guys.
Hey y'all. And quote?
Our quote for this week is, "How wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world." And Frank.
Awesome.
I like that. Well, last episode was number 73, and we took a quick look at how our modern English Bible came into existence. And now we encourage you to listen to that episode multiple times and do your personal research so that you may establish in your mind all the political, religious, and philosophical influences that were in play and contributed to its existence today. Now, speaking for us here at God Beyond the Bible, we're thankful to have access to this collection of works and are indebted to those who paid the ultimate price to pave the way for us to have that access. Inspired they were, infallible they were not.
As we've well established in our series on end time prophecy, in our opinion and the opinion of many others in the 2,000-year history of the Christian religion, it is very clear that most, if not all, of the New Testament prophecy that we've been told is still yet to occur, actually did occur. It occurred in the time frame that the Master promised it would, and that was in the generation that lived in his own era of teaching, and that was, of course, the first century AD, more specifically AD 66 to 70. That includes that sign of the coming of the Son of Man in the clouds to rescue the tribulation-stricken believers of that generation, just as he promised that he would.
So let's officially dive into segment one, because in this episode we would like to explore what we think the influence of the Almighty is in our modern generation, and affirm that He is still inspiring people, speaking to and through people, and leading humanity and believers and unbelievers alike to a better future.
Yeah, and to keep continuity here, the reason we reminded you of all the tribulation things, because we're going to talk about, and that's the question we're going to ask, is where are we? Mm-hmm. What's His influence now? So that's really what we want to talk about. If all of the things that we think are future have already occurred, then it leaves us somewhere.
Leave us?
Yeah, it leaves us somewhere. Well, there seems to be clear evidence of this divine method throughout the Bible. The narrative of the authors, which is often a narrative of events that occurred in their own lifetime, and how they explained and interpreted these events in respect to how they perceived God to be involved in the event. In short, they were often explaining how they perceived God's role as they looked back at the event. We still do that very thing today. There will be some event, be it tragic or miraculous, and as believers, we talk about that event and explain what we think was God's role in the event. Do you think that's how things work, true or false?
I even do that. Well, it was obviously in His will for it to happen that way.
So we, you know, and I think that's what we have to learn to see that the authors of the Bible did that. Mm-hmm. They saw an event and they tried to get what perspective on what was God's role in all of this, and were they always right? Probably not. No more than we are.
Right. And how we perceive God's role in anything hinges on our own personal perception of who God is, mainly whether we perceive God as a progressive form in humanity or as a regressive form in humanity.
How about force?
What did I say? Yeah, that too.
I'm so sorry. It's been a long day.
And I worked
all
day.
Big day in the office. That's okay.
I'm sorry. Is he the God of the future or the God of the past? Is he benevolent or malevolent? Did he create us with a goal in mind for humanity and is step-by-step taking us to the goal? Or did he create us and when we didn't perform to suit his expectation, he abandoned all but a select few to failure and destruction?
It's not difficult to hear either or both of these descriptions of divine attitudes being voiced from pulpits, from pulpits and books and blogs and social media posts and the like. People claiming to know what God's position is on everything from how we wear our hair to capital punishment. And the truth is, the argument for either side can be supported with the biblical text. Mm-hmm.
So, why is there a Bible text that will support almost any claim we make about God's role in any event we encounter? Because the people who contributed to the text were real people. And just like us today, God may be perceived by one group as full of wrath and indignant anger, and by another group as benevolent and forgiving, simply because that's how they've been influenced concerning the character and the role of God.
Is it fair and accurate to say that one may even experience God's character being represented both ways from a single source? In other words, might a person hear a sermon one Sunday presenting God as full of love and compassion for all humanity, and the next Sunday be confronted with a message of anger and wrath, both from the same source? Let's be honest, we don't particularly form deep, meaningful relationships with people who demonstrate these troubling qualities. So how are we to develop such a relationship with divine when this is our perception of his character?
Every believer tends to lean heavily towards one or the other of these two perceived character traits of the Most High, sometimes alternating between the dual perceptions depending on our personal convictions that we have concerning a certain issue. To be perfectly honest, we may be very inconsistent in our personal take on where God stands on an issue, depending on who the person or people are that are involved. I am one of those people that have those. In short, we may speak of God's understanding and forgiveness for one person or group of people and adopt a position of God's displeasure and judgment and wrath for another person or group of people who are doing the same thing.
So, we must ask, does our personal bias play a role in which character of God we choose to draw on?
Of course.
And you know, well, it depends. It's often depending on who is involved. Might we be guilty of playing fast and loose with our determination of what instances God is benevolent and forgiving and which ones he's angry and condemning?
He's always really benevolent and forgiving of me.
Yeah, the mistakes I make. Yeah, the mistakes I make are always just those little ones that it's easy for him
exactly.
to forgive. It's those mistakes everyone else is making, that group of people or this group of people.
So as we self-examine and meditate on that probing and revealing question, we're going to pause to regroup, and then we'll be right back with part two.
All right, we think that we've established that there are basically two ways that God is portrayed in the religious community today, and that is that he is benevolent, loving, forgiving, and always moving humanity to a better place, or that he is angry, vindictive, and moving humanity toward a violent and destructive end, or as we suggested in part one, he's an unpredictable combination of the two.
And you know, when I was reading this, this is so me 3 years ago, that unpredictable, you know, combination.
I
didn't even realize.
Is he an angry or a loving God today?
I didn't even realize how contradictive I was being of talking about God's love. But you better act right.
Just in case.
If you don't do everything right, then he's going to be the mad one.
Perhaps we could approach the topic in this manner. Let's give him the title that Jesus used for him. Jesus called him Father. he referred to him as his own father and as our father. For the sake of argument, let's consider him in the role as universal father, the father of all humanity, not just those who conform to our particular belief and religious philosophy. Using his role as father, is he an unconditionally loving, forgiving father who wants the best for his children, always guiding us with a tender, loving hand, demonstrating a character that causes us to react in love and devotion? And he's portrayed that way by many of the contributors of the Bible text.
Mm-hmm. And this may be a little off topic, but what do you think it is that scares people about using such a term as universal father? Why are people so, in your opinion, why do you think people are so
turned off? Well, is he the creator of all humanity or not?
I believe so. I mean, I think he is a universal father, but you say that and people tend to cringe.
Because it don't line up with somebody's particular belief or their religious philosophy, because it's about, we're going to do an episode on this one of these days, but it's about being right and wrong. Everything, it's got to be about right mm-hmm. and wrong. And for me to be right, I need to find a bunch of people that are wrong.
Oh, I started to say, speaking from my past, it was because I have the right way. And he's the right God, so calling him the universal is not okay because he's only my God.
Oh, that's true. I mean, I see it. It just, okay. But back to our main question. Is he a frustrated and angry father who demands our devotion and love under threat of rejection, severe discipline, sickness, and death, who equates our terror of him as heartfelt devotion to him, as is also portrayed by some of the contributors to the Bible text?
Or is he the type of father who's unpredictable when it comes to dealing with humanity? A father who shows favoritisms toward one group of his creation and heaps great blessing and guidance on some of his children, and through no fault of their own, rejects other groups as not worthy of his blessing as a father? Or perhaps is forgiving towards the actions of some at one time and is angry and full of judgment for another group who makes the same mistakes? Again, we have examples in the writings of the contributors to the Bible text who seem to have adopted this portrayal of mm-hmm. God.
And perhaps this would be a good time to ask ourselves, which of these three characteristics of a father warrants our devotion and love in the realm of humanity? In other words, which of these three depictions as a father do we embrace on a human level? Is it the one who's always benevolent? It's his unconditional love. He's always forgiving and benevolent. Is he the one that is angry and he demands perfection out of us, and if we're going to get his approval, we have to do the things that please him, or else he don't love us? Or is he a combination of the two? You know, what is that? Which father are we wanting? Are we wanting the unpredictable father? We don't know what mood he's going to be in when he gets home today.
If you break that down to an earthly father,
that's what we're trying to do.
You know, if you did that, that's clear. It's clear. So let's break it down a little bit farther. Let's look at example one.
Okay.
A father who we know loves us unconditionally. While he may not approve of some of our choices and behavior, his love for us is constant. His love is not based on how well we perform as his child, but is based on the fact that we are his child, and he wants the best for us and places opportunities in our path to be successful at life.
All right, now example two. The strict disciplinarian father who is intolerant of our poor choices and mistakes. A father who expects and accepts nothing less than perfection from his child. A father who may even place us in peril or suffering in an attempt to force us to his standard and his expectations, and perceives our fear of his angry discipline as love for him.
And example three. I've got my pages so mixed up.
That's okay.
I've got them just from one. And example three. What about the father, and we're talking about in humanity, mm-hmm. in human terms, the father who is not consistent in his expectation and demands, who with one child on one occasion may be tender and understanding, and with another child on another occasion be harsh and unforgiving, a father whose mood determines his character and reactions to situations and circumstances, a father who draws a line, setting a standard, and expects every child to meet that standard without exception, not taking into account the personality traits, natural abilities, or even the deficits of each child.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's safe to say that the character of the father who operates on the principle of unconditional love with the desire for the best for his child as his guiding motivation, that's the one we would choose.
Of course.
And with God knowing this about us, do we really think he is somehow convinced that he can bring out our best and win our devotion and love by tactics that arouse guilt, shame, and fear? To put it plainly, in any relationship, does fear promote love and devotion?
I was reading a book a while back, and one of the lines in the book was, you cannot love something that you fear.
No.
No.
You can fear, never love
fear
anything.
Fear does not produce love.
And, you know, people who see God as that, I have to tell you, I read an article this last week, and it was on biblical gender roles.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Yeah. And it really upset me because the whole point of the article was how the man rules over the wife. And it was how the man rules over the wife by fear. I'm going to discipline you.
Oh my
if
gosh.
You don't behave the
who,
way
I... I don't even want to know who you were reading
I
after.
Don't even know because I don't... It was just something that popped. But that made me... That kind of shows you, though, how you perceive God is how you're going to perceive your relationships with others, too.
Yeah, and you know, most of the people that see him as angry and full of anger and indignant
well.
Righteousness and all of that stuff, they're usually pretty judgmental people mm-hmm, themselves.
Mm-hmm, yes.
But God's never angry with them.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I know that a lot of us out there are thinking about how many times the Bible text commands us to fear God. And that's confusing when we perceive the Bible as a single divine work instead of what it really is, a collection of individuals who perceived God differently and wrote according to how they perceived him. Most of this fear God comes through the Jewish perspective of the Old Testament. The Jews maintained their religious and political power over their own people with fear tactics. And we must consider that this came from over 400 years of exposure to the Egyptian perception of appeasing the angry gods.
Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind that Moses himself participated in and was a product of a culture that attributed every negative, now I'm talking about the Egyptian culture, 40 years there, he was an Egyptian, was a product of a culture that attributed every negative event from a hangnail to a famine to be the result of their failure to properly make appeasement offerings to a god. Now, keep in mind, just as I'm lost again. Okay. Let's go back and do that again. That everything from a hangnail, that Moses was conditioned this way, everything from a hangnail to a famine that was a result of their failure to properly make an appeasement offering to a god. Now keep in mind, just as we often do today, we experience and tell the story according to the philosophy we adopt. If an event occurs, the person writing about the event, if you're that person, has the privilege of controlling the narrative and determining the reason for the event and the role they believe God played in the event, good or bad.
Mm-hmm. All right, so allow us to pause a moment. We're going to regroup and we'll be right back with part three.
Okay, and our topic for today is centered around the interpretation of the prophetic part of the New Testament having been fulfilled and Christ actually having appeared and rescued some or even many from the peril of the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, making that the period of great tribulation. Any person who becomes convinced that this is true and embraces this truth will have to then ask themselves where this leaves us as believers. And what is God's role and method of influence in this kingdom age that we are now in?
And as we've already discussed, our perception of what type of father we see God as will determine how we see him interacting in the age in which we live. So if different contributors to the Bible viewed God in very different ways and recorded their experiences influenced by their interpretation of God's personality and character, is there any way to get a view of the true character of God and his attitude towards the humanity he created?
In spite of all the contradicting narratives of the many who claim that they are speaking for God or representing God's attitude or opinion on a topic or event, the fact is, putting the writer's slanted narrative aside, there exists in those narratives an underlying and consistent character of who God really is and how he leads and interacts with humanity.
So let us present the principle of breadcrumbs. It is based on the idea that God does not so much herd us like cattle or force us into his desire for us to discover him and build a loving relationship with him, but he actually does it very subtly. He doesn't hand us a diagram, a map, or a set of craftily designed steps that if we methodically and carefully follow that we'll be successful, but instead he gently leads us in the direction that he knows will result in blessing and discovering him. He does that by laying small clues for us to follow, in the same manner that we might entice an animal of nature into our presence by placing little bits of food slowly and cautiously and coaxing them closer and closer to us.
Now, this single principle of breadcrumbs has been a consistent and common thread that runs the length of the Bible, regardless of the opinion of the narrative. God has slowly and gently brought us as humanity into this place we are right now, and he will continue to lay the breadcrumbs for us to follow to the place of blessing he desires for us. That's individually and as humankind collectively.
One might look as far back as the incident following Adam and Eve's ejection from the garden. Now, the writer of the narrative clearly states his interpretation of the whole matter. Cain was a jealous older brother who didn't have the gumption to, are you ready for it, make an offering that was sufficient to appease a demanding God. So Cain's offering is rejected, while his brother Abel's offering is qualified as an acceptable appeasement. According to the narrative, Cain became angry and jealous of his brother's acceptance and then murdered his brother Abel. In line with the writer's belief of what God's character and role in the matter was, the writer tells us that now Cain must receive God's justice.
So based on our overall opinion of how God deals with the murderer, what would we expect Cain's punishment to be?
Well, if it was Moses writing this, he surely thought
it would be a swift and certain death.
Ought to be put to death.
Yeah. But God's justice was not a life for a life. While it was a punishment, it was a punishment that ultimately led to the advancement of humankind. Cain was sent out to make a life for himself out of the presence of his known family. And he was afraid for his own life. He's actually recorded to have said, my punishment is too great to bear, and if you send me out there, they will kill me.
Now, in previous episodes, we've already covered the ground of who we think it was that Cain was afraid of. It was another race of, people, possibly the sixth day male and female descendants. Now, just ask you to visit episode 9, titled, Were Adam and Eve Alone on the Earth? And that'll clear some of this up for you. Okay. Cain pleads that his punishment is too great. Those who perceive God as a difficult to please, hardcore, straight down the line disciplinarian father will argue that any punishment short of death was a light sentence.
Many neglect to point out that not only did God not enact the death penalty, but he placed an order of protection and preservation on Cain. We are told that God put a mark on Cain that would prevent anyone who might want to kill Cain from doing so.
Now, let's just stop right there, and before you go on tracing to that next part, if the story ended right there and we had no more narrative except right there, we should be able to determine, well, God's a very forgiving.
Yeah. But somehow we change that because I've heard it said that that was a curse that God, that it was a curse.
A curse
and
upon
his
head.
Yeah. You know, and I never really looked at it. This opened
my eyes. Look how benevolent God was in his action with Cain.
Yeah.
And he even spoke to him like a father. We're recorded, it says that he said, son, if you do good, good things will come to you.
Yeah.
Do good. If your heart's right and you do good, good things will come to you. But
this doesn't have to be the end of everything.
Yeah, this is not the end of anything. Yeah, this is not, it's not over. It's not over.
So what was the result of this light sentence? As we mentioned in an earlier episode, through God's chosen action, Cain's descendants brought us music and song, the domestication of animals, and great advancements in metallurgy. The human race as a whole benefited from God's reaction to a tragic event. God took a terrible event and led humanity into a new age of better living.
So time and again, we read the narrative and we think we know what God's doing by the way the writer perceives what he thinks God is doing. But if we look outside the writer's perception, we can see God laying these trails of breadcrumbs each time advancing humanity to a better place.
The breadcrumb principle is as true for us today as it has always been. It is true for us as humanity, and better yet, as individuals. If we reflect on our own lives, we may discover that God lays a trail of breadcrumbs for us in our personal pursuits, if we will but adapt to his subtle signals and cues. It may be an unexplainable gut feeling about a situation or someone. It may be that we have an encounter with someone in a setting that is completely unassociated with what we normally do, and that person ends up being a connection to an advancement in job or career or a house or apartment or something else we're in need of.
If we consider our own lives, we may be able to see that we have been clearly influenced by the trail of breadcrumbs dropped by the divine for us to follow. Oh, and by the way, if you're still unsure of what kind of father he is, Jesus summed it up when he said to his audience that if we want good for our children and realize the importance of giving them good things, then how much more is our Heavenly Father able and willing to give us good things? History tells us that he will leave a trail of breadcrumbs to a better future if we will but look for them.
As for humanity as a whole, we are convinced that he uses every event, even tragic ones, to bring us to a better future. We are already living in a much better future than the generation preceding us. Yes. We aren't implying that God causes the tragedies any more than he caused Cain to kill Abel. We do believe that just as any loving father desires to do, he will use the circumstances to lead us to a better place individually and as humanity.
All right, if no one has anything else, as always, until next time, may God's grace, peace, and love be on you, in you, and radiate out from each of you, our fellow seekers, from all of us here at God Beyond the Bible.
Did you enjoy listening to God Beyond the Bible? Do you have an idea for an episode? Connect with us today. Visit our website at godbeyondthebible.com, all one word, or send us an email at email@godbeyondthebible.com, or you can visit us on Facebook. Just type God Beyond the Bible into the search bar.